Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Today is Sunday, November 6th. Overnight, the sun slipped an hour. You're welcome here if you arrived an hour early this morning. We know who you are. You're welcome here if you're still straggling in, even with that extra hour of sleep. You're welcome here if you agree with Genesis 1:28. It says, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it." You're welcome here if you believe that with having reached a global population of 7 billion this past week, or so we're told, we can cross Genesis 1:28 off our things to do. You are welcome here, grudgingly, if you are the one who hacked our website last night. Though if you are here, our people would like to speak with your people. And finally, you're welcome here this morning. You're welcome if you're here this morning because of last night's earthquake. Salvation is as easy as signing our membership book in the narthex. We are universalists here, so. William. Yesterday, we experienced the ferocious Kansas wind. Last night, we experienced the shaking of the earth. How about this morning, let's light a fire? Will you do that? Yeah? Can you do that? That was William. He's my new friend in the sound booth, so appreciate his help, and I hope he recovers. All right, I call your attention to the announcements listed inside the order of worship. There's a lot that goes on between Sundays in our fellowship, and you'll find those activities listed there, and also in our monthly newsletter, which I commend to you. I was handed one additional announcement. Last chance for to order fresh pecans and pecan products for gifts and baking. Deadline is November 10th. You need to see Anel Forster. Anel, would you? There you are. Very good. All right, we'll begin with our opening hymn, number 203, All Creatures of the Earth and Sky. Please stand as you are able.
All five verses.
Okay, all five verses, I'm told.
Thank you.
All right. At this time in the service, we take a few minutes to share important milestones in our lives, those that we would consider a joy or a concern. The microphone will come to you.
We have two joys. The first is Judy's increased freedom in her fourth week of recovery from a fractured pelvis. And in her usual very vigorous way, she has rushed her healing, if that can be done. And the other joy is that when we spent our summer on the porch that we have at our duplex, we spent most of our life out there, despite the heat. And now it's an all-season room so that we can enjoy every season out there. So we are very delighted and looking forward to winter.
Our joy is that we're back. We just spent the last 6 weeks in California, which is a wonderful place to visit. And our daughter, of course, is there, so we had a great time. But it's nice to be back and see everyone.
I have a joy that my sister got her cast off 2 days ago.
My joy is that I am also back from California. I'm glad to be back with you all. Had two wonderful weeks in California, partly with my family and partly with my yoga family. And my foot is very much better. A lot of people have been asking about it. So I'm walking, I'm dancing, and I'm glad to be with you.
My older sister, Connie Jo, was T-boned in her car in Wichita about a week ago, so she's rehabbing from that. Things are going fairly well, all things considered. Nothing real serious, or they're finally determining after some early issues. Joy is that I have a harvest jar that will be included with the faculty art show at the Beach Museum. The opening is Thursday, if anybody needs an excuse to go to the Beach Museum.
Shirley Hobrock, we're glad that Barbara Hacker's back. That must mean her back is better.
I got both joy and concern. A joy that I'm going to take my mom to see her brother in Alabama, and a concern that my brother's still looking for it, so there you go.
Inel Forrester, just hearing Anna speak, I wanted to say that thank you. She just made a contribution to NPR, National Public Radio, and want to remind everybody this is National Public Radio Week, so please renew your renewal so that we have some uninterrupted music, news, and fun. Thank you, Anna.
All right. Thank you for sharing those important parts of your life. I think it's time now for the children to come forward.
Can you give this to Corey for the children's? Thank you. Okay. Kids of all ages, come on up. Woohoo! Yeah. I'm going to need some volunteers today to be in my play called Chicken Little. So if you can read, help me read. And we're also going to need some other characters that don't read. Okay, so let's start with the readers, our reading people. Okay, Destiny. There you go. Indigo. You get to be Henny Penny. Okay, Ducky Lucky, Lily, great, Goosey Lucy, okay, Turkey Lurkey, Ellie, okay, Maeve, great, I've got one more for you, you get to be Foxy Loxy. Okay, now I'm going to need some other volunteers, and these are going to be the animals that are friends with these animals. So I'm going to need a dog. Will you be a dog? Okay, go on up there and pretend to be a dog. Just get down on all fours. Yeah. Kitty, are you going to be my kitty cat today, Jocelyn? Great, kitty cat. Great. I need a snake. Fantastic. Okay. I also need a rabbit. You think you're up for it, Sam? Great. Would you rather be a cougar? It's like in the leopard family. Okay, great. And I could use a rat. You're not into rats. How about a monkey? No. What would you like to be, Burke? Oh, a bird. I didn't even think about a bird. Fantastic. You'll be the rat? Okay, great. And we need another dog. Could you be a dog? Okay, great. And Owen, you're going to be a cat, too. Okay. Wow, we have our whole cast of characters. We're ready. Okay. I'm going to play the narrator, and we're going to need to use... Oh, perfect. We're going to need to use the microphone, so I will come up to you. Just raise your hand when it's your turn so we can all hear. Yes, you can be a lizard. Yes, okay. We no longer have a cougar, now we have a lizard. Okay. All right. Chicken Little was in the woods one day when an acorn fell on her head. It scared her so much she trembled all over. She shook so hard half her feathers fell out. Okay, Chicken Little.
Help, help. The sky is falling. I have to go tell the king.
So she ran in great fright to tell the king. Along the way, she met Henny Penny.
Where are you going, Chicken Little?
Oh, help. The sky is falling.
How do you know?
I saw it with my own eyes and heard it with my own ears, and part of it fell on my head.
This is terrible. Just terrible. We'd better hurry up.
So they both ran as fast as they could. Soon they met Ducky Lucky.
Where are you going, Chicken Little and Henny Penny?
The sky is falling. The sky is falling. We're going to tell the king.
How do you know?
I saw it with my own eyes. I heard it with my own ears. And part of it fell on my head.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. We better run.
So they all ran as fast as they could. Soon they met Goosey Lucy walking down the roadside.
Hello there. Where are you all going in such a hurry?
We're running for our lives.
The sky is falling.
And we're going to tell the king.
How do you know the sky is falling?
I saw it with my own eyes. I heard it with my own ears. And part of it fell on my head.
Goodness, then I better run with you.
And they all ran in great fright across a field. Before long, they met Turkey Lurkey strutting back and forth.
Hello there, Chicken Little, Henny Penny, Ducky Lucky, and Goosey Lucy. Where are you all going in such a hurry?
Help! Help!
We're running for our lives!
The sky is falling!
And we're running to tell the king.
How do you know the sky is falling?
I saw it with my own eyes, I heard it with my own ears, and a part of it fell on my head.
Oh dear, I was suspected the sky would fall someday. I'd better run with you.
So they ran with all their might until they met Foxy Loxy.
Well, where are you rushing on such a fine day?
Help! Help! It's not a fine day at all. The sky is falling and we're running to tell the king.
How do you know the sky is falling?
I saw it with my eyes, I heard it with my own ears, and part of it fell on my head.
I see. Well then, follow me and I'll show you the way to the king.
Okay, all the animals follow Maeve, Foxy Loxy, off to her den. It doesn't end well. So Foxy Loxy led Chicken Little, Henny Penny, Ducky Lucky, Goosey Lucy, and Turkey Lurkey across a field and through the woods. He led them straight to her den, and they never saw the king to tell him that the sky is falling. Oh, no. Okay, come on back over. We'll process the story. We'll process the story. All the animals. Foxy Loxy. So today, the adults are going to hear a talk by a man whose name is Ben Champion. And Mr. Champion is sort of like a modern-day Chicken Little. He has, in a really good way, though, he has found out some things about weather patterns, just like Chicken Little, but he's not going to be tricked by Foxy Loxy. Instead, he's been going around and successfully telling farmers, and he's here to tell our fellowship members today all about what's going to happen when these weather changes affect growing patterns. He's being super brave and telling knowledge that he has to people so that they can have the knowledge too. So the moral of the story, outside of don't get tricked by Foxy Loxy, is that when you have knowledge, like the sky is falling or there are weather pattern changes that could affect the environment, that you should be brave to tell people about those changes. Okay? And don't get tricked by Foxy Loxy. Okay. Go now in peace.
Well, that's always a hard act to follow. But that's good. Our reading this morning is from an unusual source, probably for our service, the New York Times. And I share it this morning not as a news article. It's from more than a year ago. I share it because it's directly relevant to the topic that we're as part of our program this morning. And it's of regional interest. The dateline is October of 2010, Salina, Kansas. Residents of this deeply conservative city do not put much stock in scientific predictions of climate change. Don't mention global warming, warned Nancy Jackson, chairwoman of the Climate and Energy Project, a small nonprofit group that aims to get people to rein in the fossil fuel emissions that contribute to climate change. And don't mention Al Gore. People out here just hate him. Saving energy, though, is another matter. If the Heartland is to seriously reduce its dependence on coal and oil, Ms. Jackson and others decided the issues must be separated. So the project ran an experiment to see if by focusing on thrift, patriotism, spiritual conviction, and economic prosperity, they could rally residents of six Kansas towns to take meaningful steps to conserve energy and consider renewable fuels. The energy experiment started as a kitchen table challenge 3 years ago. Over dinner, Wes Jackson, the president of the Land Institute, which promotes environmentally sustainable agriculture, complained to Ms. Jackson, his daughter-in-law, that even though many local farmers would suffer from climate change, few of them believed that it was happening or were willing to take steps to avoid it. Only 48% of people in the Midwest agree with the statement that there is solid evidence that the average temperature on Earth has been getting warmer. It's from a poll conducted in the fall of 2009 by the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. It's far fewer than in other regions of the country. The Jacksons knew firsthand that such skepticism was not just broad, but also deep. They felt it was becoming a cultural marker that helped some Kansans define themselves. Nevertheless, Ms. Jackson felt so strongly that this opposition could be overcome. She left a job as development director at the University of Kansas to start the Climate and Energy Project with a one-time grant from the Land Institute. The project is now independent. At the outset, she commissioned focus groups of independents and Republicans around Wichita and Kansas City to get a sense of where they stood. Many participants suggested that global warming could be explained mostly by natural Earth cycles, and a vocal minority even asserted that it was a cynical hoax perpetrated by climate scientists who were greedy for grants. Yet Ms. Jackson found plenty of openings. Many lamented the nation's dependence on foreign oil. Some articulated an amorphous desire, often based in religious values, to protect the earth. Some even spoke of changes in the natural world, birds arriving weeks earlier in the spring than they had before, leading her to wonder whether deep down they might suspect that climate change was afoot. Ms. Jackson settled on a three-pronged strategy. Invoking the notion of thrift, she set out to persuade towns to compete with one another to become more energy efficient. She worked with civic leaders to embrace green jobs as a way of shoring up or rescuing their communities. And she spoke with local ministers about creation care, the obligation of Christians to act as stewards of the world that God gave them, even creating a sermon bank with talking points they could download. Relatively little was said about climate. "I don't recall us being recruited under a climate change label at all," said Stacy Huff, an executive for the Coronado Area Council of the Boy Scouts of America, which was enlisted to help the project. Mr. Huff describes himself as somewhat skeptical about global warming. He said that the project workers emphasized conservation for future generations when they recruited his group. That message resonated, and the scouts went door-to-door in low-income neighborhoods to deliver and install weatherization kits. "It is in our DNA to leave the planet a better place than we found it," he said. Elliot Lawn, a community development planner from Merriam, a city that reduced its energy use by 5%, said that when public meetings were held on the six-town competition to save energy, some residents offered their view that global warming was a hoax. But, he said, they were very eager to hear about saving money. That's what really motivated them. This reading is excerpted from the full story. I hope to be able to provide a link to that with the podcast when it gets posted. All right, we pause now to provide an opportunity to share our gifts of treasure that support our fellowship. Our speaker this morning is Ben Champion. Ben is a director of sustainability at K-State. It's a position he's had for about 3.5 years. He's going to describe his experience working with a team of K-State and University of Nebraska researchers to discuss climate change with rural populations and agricultural producers in the Plains States. He hopes his model will be an effective vehicle for changing the conversation in the rural Great Plains about our evolving understanding of changing weather patterns. The title of his talk is Climate Change, Changing the Conversation. Ben.
Thanks, Doug. So that is indeed a very tough act to follow. The children doing a very good rendition of Chicken Little. I was not expecting that, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit. It's true in a way. I am one of those greedy grant seekers. Getting a fine grant from National Science Foundation to do this project that Doug just mentioned. But I would submit to you that the Chicken Little tale is quite deep in its meaning, and it's very hard to identify those foxy ladies, or foxy loxies. Sometimes it's hard to find the foxy ladies too, but but that's for another day. As I was watching that play go on, I was thinking, boy, you know, the climate skeptic character is missing from that story. But then by the end, I was actually questioning that. So, you know, are the climate scientists the Chicken Littles, or are they the foxy loxies? I think that's something that our society is trying to figure out collectively. Some people would say, by God, there's so many problems in the world today. Why do we need to add on another one about climate change? These people are just making it up. They're the foxy loxies distracting us from the real challenges. We need economic growth. We need, you know, the developing countries have all kinds of humanitarian issues, and we've got so many challenges. All of these climate scientists, they're just looking for the grant dollars, looking to, you know, to fund careers and to distract us from the real challenges, putting the resources where we need to. But what if they're right? And the sky is falling. And, oh, by the way, when the sky falls, it's going to impact all those other things too. Well, that's a pretty big problem to deal with. So it's a hard one. So you'll have to bear with me. I am in an academic institution, and we are completely wedded to PowerPoint. I can't get around it. But I also think that a lot of the things that bear on this issue really need to be expressed through graphical means and cannot just be expressed through words. So I'll try to breeze through the wordy parts and get to the fun graphics. So here's a little warning to us. Due to climate change, Groundhog Day is going to be going to January. Well, this isn't actually true, because this is a Union of Concerned Scientists April Fool's Day prank. But you know, it's the kind of thing that might get people's attention. But this one's not a prank, and if I didn't check to see if we had internet access, there's actually a video on this, but I just summarized the video content for you all. Due to changing weather patterns in the regions that produce the Arabica coffee bean. Coffee plants require some very specific conditions in order to produce well. You only really can have these coffee bean plants in specific elevations of Ethiopia and elsewhere. That's why all the bean bags have these, you know, four very exotic names and locations to them, is because it's actually some pretty specific climate conditions that produce the ability to make coffee beans. And Starbucks, as director of sustainability, testified in Congress recently on the dramatic declines they're seeing in even established farms, have been established for a long time producing coffee, declines of up to about 30% recently. And so what Starbucks is actually contemplating is a world without coffee. And what would that mean to the Starbucks franchise? Well, I saw a different article saying that they were starting to seriously consider investing in juiceterias. So they're juice bars, basically, making juice drinks instead of coffee. So in a couple decades, we very well could see that the dominant form of Starbucks is juice bars and not coffee shops. So that's something that hits home to a lot of people who rely upon coffee. Okay, this is a little graphic that's pretty important. There was a study in 2009 by the Yale Climate Communication Project that did national opinion polling on the issue of climate change and found that people's viewpoints basically fell into about six different categories, ranging from what they called alarmed all the way to dismissive. And they also, furthermore, were able to show the rough percentages of how many people generally were in each category. And the alarmed people are basically definitely chicken littling. I mean, the sky is falling. We've got to do something now about it, or we won't have coffee in the future. The concerned people are basically, they believe that global climate change is happening, that it's an important issue. It may there may be other important issues in the world, but it certainly is significant enough to warrant collective action to deal with it. The cautious basically say, well, it might be happening, it's probably happening, but I'm not sure that it's something that we should collectively act upon. The disengaged are basically ambivalent about whether it is or isn't happening. The doubtful are still engaged in the topic, but definitely don't think it's happening and will argue about it. But they're at least educating themselves enough to argue. That's probably where the skeptics lie. And then the dismissive, basically, once you mention the words climate change, they shut down. You can't really even talk to them. So those are the basic categories. And in May of this year, they redid it to see where are we now. And that's where we are now. So we've seen a pretty dramatic shift in just 2 years' time in this country, going from 33% concerned to 27% concerned, from 18% alarmed to 12% alarmed, 19% cautious to 25% cautious, and all of the D categories have gone, I believe they've gone, well, disengaged has gone down, but doubtful has gone up, and dismissive has gone up. So we're moving toward the right, to the D's. A lot of potential reasons for this. I'll get to that. So how many of you would say that you are comfortable with this word climate and what it means? Raise your hand if you feel comfortable. Okay. Okay, that's pretty good, actually. It's better than the last time I gave this kind of talk. So since you all feel pretty comfortable, I'm going to breeze through this pretty quickly, and you'll have to forgive me for going quickly because I don't want to go over on time, and I'd like to keep enough time for conversation. But it's a complicated science, but there's a few things that we should probably note about it. So one thing is climate is a problem in terms of communicating it to the public because you can't directly sense it. It's an abstraction. It's a concept that we came up with. You don't experience climate, you experience weather. And what climate is a pattern, okay? We experience weather, and we, as human beings, we tend to take our perceptions and try to build models out of them to describe the patterns that exist in all of that experience. And that's what climate is. It's the name for this kind of set of patterns that we use to describe what would the weather pattern typically be like for a place. I mean, in Kansas, we obviously know we have four seasons, okay? That characteristic is an element of our climate. We typically think that the seasonal highs in summer are going to be, you know, in the low 100s probably, and the seasonal lows in the wintertime are going to be down in the, you know, teens or single digits oftentimes. And there's variation from year to year, but there's a kind of pattern to it. That description of that pattern is what climate is. So my PowerPoint isn't doing a good job here. Okay. All of those little dots, if this graphic was actually showing what it was supposed to be showing, there would be a cloud, basically, that encompasses all of those dots. And what climate change is about is adding a couple more dots that changes the shape of the cloud that encompasses what we call climate in this region or in any other region. And that's not to say that those other dots don't still exist. We still may get weather in the old categories, but we'll see some new ones too that we've never seen before. And some of that newness may cause things like, well, in the case of Ethiopia, coffee bean crop may falter. In the case of Kansas, well, if our nighttime temperatures raise substantially above 80 degrees during a particular time of the year, then our wheat crop fails. And as the number one wheat producer in the country, that's a pretty important thing. Okay, so how would we do this thing called climate science. Well, it involves models, and the models have, from the early 60s through to today, have gotten increasingly complex, incorporating more and more Earth processes. But it's important to realize that these models are not just these kind of weird computer simulations. They're actually based in actual science, okay? Somebody in a laboratory in the 1800s determined that carbon dioxide absorbs light energy at a certain wavelength. And that's a physical process that is very well understood. And what the climate models do is simply take that very well understood knowledge and try and build it into a simulation that is not just based in a laboratory, but what would happen throughout the Earth if conditions changed. And these are the kinds of Earth processes that they try and build into these models. Okay, it is probably not appropriate for me to go through every element of this diagram, but we've got incoming sunlight, and it does dirt some certain things. Some of it bounces off clouds, some of it gets absorbed by the atmosphere, some of it makes all the way down to the ground where we feel it, and it makes plants grow and stuff. And then some of it, the energy that comes down here, some of it's radiated up that way, and some of it's through water evaporating. But a whole bunch of it is radiated through something called surface radiation, where it then interacts with the atmosphere, and a bunch gets back radiated, okay? And this is that greenhouse effect. It's this cycling of energy between Earth and atmosphere that keeps, it's like a blanket, it keeps the Earth relatively warm. And what I would like to call attention to is that the numbers we're looking at here, okay, that 350 is more than twice the amount of incoming sunlight that comes in, okay? So that's very important. This is not just a small effect. This is absolutely what keeps our planet livable. And when you change what's going on here by even small percentages, the total number can be very large, and it can amount to an effect that's similar to the sun basically doubling in size or something like that. So it's not something to be treated as a trivial issue. And these are... on the other side, not trying to simulate the climate, we actually observe what's going on, and these are four different sets of data showing the globe's temperature from 1880s until the 2000s, and it's been going up pretty rapidly, actually. And what's the key thing that is driving it? Well, it's hard to say exactly what's driving it, but if you combine that picture from before, looking at that greenhouse gas cycle, and you say, well, what is the cause of all of that cycle? Well, it's the greenhouse gases. We're pretty sure about that. And what is the one thing that's tracking the same periods of increase in temperature out of all of these potential different sources of energy in the Earth system? The one line that's going up is greenhouse gases. So, I mean, is that enough to... The correlation is not causation, but is that enough to put some faith in? I mean, increasingly the public doesn't think so. This is a graph of extreme weather events, so another indicator that things are changing. And there's been quite an uptick in the past few years, and climate science would predict that that's going to continue to increase. And here are Kansas, northeast Kansas, spring temperatures trends from 1895 to 2000s, and we see a very strong pattern of increasing temperatures. So even here, not at the global average level, but in Kansas, we see the pattern. I'm not going to go through that. So we've had this group called the IPCC, the Climate Skeptics. Believe they're a spawn of the devil, and it's a bunch of scientists really that collectively try to figure out what science as a whole profession is telling us. And my colleague John Harrington put together this slide, and he likes the Margaritaville is a good model for what we've been hearing. So in Margaritaville there's this kind of refrain, and he says first of all it's nobody's fault, and then the next verse says it's could be my fault, and the third verse says, well, it's my own damn fault. And that's kind of what the IPCC said in 1990. They said, well, there's an increase that we're observing, but it's hard to say whether human factors are really an important contributor. And the second assessment says, well, the balance of evidence suggests that we're doing something here, that it's human-caused, but there's still some doubt there. So it could be our fault. We're not sure yet. And the third assessment says there's new and stronger evidence that most of the warming observed over the last 50 years is attributable to human activity. So that's fairly conclusive that we are driving this. And then, my last slide didn't work, but the fourth assessment, though, basically says that it's pretty much undeniable. There's just, but they also then couched that language in some very scientific language to try and detract from them basically saying that we are really radically changing the Earth. Okay, so, but the IPCC is really not a voice of that the public generally trusts, and so we need some other things to get the point across. And so increasingly, the government and other entities are interested, and we've been exploring how to do this. You heard the article about Nancy Jackson and her grant effort exploring different ways of framing these issues. My project that I'll tell you about in a few minutes is another example of a government-funded effort to try and change the conversation. I'm going to show you a few slides here from a group that's related to the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. So it's Climate Communication is the name of the website. You can find it very easily by just Googling that. And on their front page, they have this dynamic simulator, which I've taken some screenshots from to basically give you the gist of what it's saying. And so what they're doing is they've got a map here, and it starts in 1979 and goes until 2090. Okay, so they're trying to project into the future. And what they're graphing here is the number of days during the year in which the high will be above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And so on the far left, the light yellow represents temperatures where there are fewer than 10 days a year that reach 100 degrees. And so you can see in 1979, almost the entire country is in that light yellow, where there's, you know, very few days a year, well, in most places, no days a year that reach 100, but in some places, probably plenty of days, but maybe less than 10. And then you can see some beginnings of pockets where the colors are changing and there's more than 10 days a year that are above 100 degrees. And of course, in the Mojave Desert in California, it's pretty red there, and there's a lot of days above 100 degrees. But at the far end of the spectrum, the dark reds are where you're reaching 100 to 120 days plus a year. So a third of the year or more where the high temperatures are 100 degrees or more. And so you've got variations in between, and somewhere in the middle there is like 50 or 60 days a year. Okay, so 1979, here's where we are now. Okay, so there's been a substantial amount of places, including Kansas, where we're seeing over 10 days a year, and in some cases over 20 days a year of 100 degree temperatures. Certainly this summer we saw more than that. So this from there to there, that's actual data. We observed that. Okay, there were measurements on the ground that observed these things, and then from here on out, it's projections based upon climate models. But 20 years from now, we see that not a whole lot of some intensification in our part of the country, but what you see is a large portion of the rest of the U.S. starting to see a lot more 100 degree days. Even up in places like Montana and North Dakota, you're seeing substantial periods of 100-degree temperatures. It's 20 years from now. 20 years after that, we're starting to see some real color intensification in our neck of the woods and farther north as well. And you see most of Arizona is becoming quite a desolate place. And southern Texas is starting to get to become like the deserts of Southern California and Arizona. And then the last slide, 2090, where we're looking at in Kansas having something like 70 to 80 days a year of 100-degree temperatures. So I don't know. This is pretty important stuff. Okay, so why are we having such a hard time talking about this? Well, there's a recent paper in Physics Today that laid out a bunch of different reasons, and so this is what I kind of distilled it down and paraphrased it, but this is what they're saying. Well, that first of all, it's problems because the policies to address this issue are going to impact the economy. They're going to impact people's personal livelihoods, and people already have plenty of worries on their plates regarding those issues. And so there's kind of a threshold. You can only pile so much doubt and concern on people in terms of their ability to act. So that's one problem. Second problem is we've had a really well-funded, well-coordinated misinformation campaign. A whole bunch of blogosphere out there, most of which are have their own funding, like the climate scientists have their funding. They have their own funding, and they're really, really good at causing disinformation. And the book Merchants of Doubt does a very good job of explaining that these are the not just the same type of people, but the exact same scientists who were funded by the tobacco industry through the Tobacco Institute to raise doubts in the public mind about the risks of tobacco in the 60s and 70s. The same Frederick Sykes and a couple others. Literally, they're the same people that that were in the 90s part of the development of the climate science. They're not the only guys involved in this, okay? But the beginnings of it in the 90s, the beginnings of the funded climate skeptic machine was those same people. Because it was very successful for a while. Yeah. Well, this is the problem is, she asks, hasn't their credibility been impacted by that correspondence or that connection? And the folks that would bring attention to that connection, first of all, it took us a while to figure it out. The book was just written 2 years ago, and it's something that was going on 20 years ago. And second of all, let's look at some of the other items here, actually. Some of the other issues of the climate science community not being as good to communicators as the climate skeptics is part of the problem. If the climate change community was as good at raising those connections in the public's eye as the climate denialists, then I think we would have had a bigger public conversation about those connections, but we haven't for one reason or another. So another one of the big problems is that the general public doesn't know what science is. They don't know how it's done. They don't, so they doubt. It's easy to raise doubts in a public that doesn't understand what science is, how it's funded, how scientists do their work, how there is always doubt in science. There's always someone asking whether the information, the knowledge we've developed is true to life or not. And so the general public is not really very well prepared for this sophisticated conversation. There's another cultural element, though, this issue that weather is kind of always been viewed as the providence of God. And we have a deeply religious tradition in America. Our culture is deeply grounded in religion, and so there is a very strong sense of how could we be changing something as powerful as the weather? It just doesn't stand to reason in many people's minds. We call weather events that are extreme, we call them acts of God. We still do. So that's an issue. And the media typically portray climate as a controversy, not as something that is fairly well, firmly established. And so they cover both sides relatively equally, although that's really mostly appropriate for an older mentality about the media. With new media and the blogs, I mean, all bets are off. It's the Wild West. So equal time is not even a principle when it comes to blogs. And then the scientists themselves, focused on the purity of the scientific enterprise, are very thoroughly entrenched in talking about probabilities, uncertainties, and using jargon that the public just can't understand. And go back to the scientific illiteracy issue there. Okay, so there's other folks that have tried to look at it through different ways. This is a image of this guy, Greg Craven, who put out a YouTube video. He was a high school teacher, put out a YouTube video in 2007, and basically argued that we don't need to understand the climate science in order to think about our risks. And this went viral, and his basic framework here is, you've got two different scenarios about global warming, okay? Either it's not happening or it's happening. And either we do something about it or we don't, okay? Now, it's obviously a little more nuanced than that, but these are the general two-by-two categories. And so think about the scenario. If we do something about it, but it turns out not to be happening, then we spent a lot of money for nothing, basically, and maybe it results in a huge global depression, all right? Think worst case. Could really knock the economy off its hinges. That would be bad. But if it's true and we do something about it, well, we still endure the costs and maybe that economic downfall, but we also save our hides and protect, at least retain some climate stability so that we can, you know, try to recover from that economic shock. Well, if it isn't happening, we don't do anything about it, then, you know, we've still got all the problems in the world that exist, but at least we didn't add one to them. But if we don't do anything about it and it does happen, well, it'll probably cause enough economic downfall that we'll have that depression anyway. Plus, we'll have the social problems, political problems, public health problems, ecological and environmental problems that go along with it. So in terms of thinking about risks, he basically says, we spend all our time debating whether it's true or false, when we should be debating whether to do something or not. And when you think about it, it's like a lottery. You're buying a lottery ticket that includes these possible scenarios, or a lottery ticket that includes these possible scenarios, okay? And which lottery ticket do you want to buy? And he says, well, the risk of that is, that's a pretty substantial risk, but this risk is way bigger. So we should probably go with this one. We should probably go with this one. Well, I don't know, maybe we should go with that one. So anyway, that's a risk-oriented way of thinking about it, not a is it happening or not way of thinking about it. Okay, so I got to skip past this, but basically he got into big trouble in last December when he gave a talk at a big scientific meeting. And okay, so I've got I need to really rush through and tell you a little bit about our project. It's a Central Great Plains project, clearly an important region because of the amount of animal feed, food, biofuels, et cetera, that comes from this region. But it's also really rural, very sparsely populated. You can see from the colors there. And we all know because we live here. Interesting region climatologically. Huge precipitation gradient from western Kansas to eastern Kansas. Basically a semi-arid desert in western Kansas and basically the Ozarks in eastern Kansas. So about 13, 14 inches of rain in western Kansas to about 40 inches of rain in eastern Kansas. It's a bigger gradient than between eastern Kansas and the east coast of the U.S. So we exist in a zone of climate transition. That is our climate. And it is expressed through extreme weather events of all kinds that we're all very familiar with. When a front comes through, it does crazy things. That's what transition zones look like. So our grant is a two-year planning grant, at basically asking the question, what kind of education programming do we need in this region to try and prepare for the future? And if we're successful, we'll be getting another 5 years of grant money to actually implement some of those programs. So we're not actually doing education work yet. We're trying to prepare for a large campaign that would be happening over the next half decade or more. And it's a partnership-oriented grant where we really need to be working with the stakeholders, the people we want to educate as much as possible. And they can actually help shape the development of the programs themselves. This is part of the changing of the conversation that needs to happen. Okay, I got to skip that. That's the Great Plains. So we're located in Kansas. There's pretty centrally located in the overall Great Plains, and our partner's in Nebraska. Nebraska's also pretty much... So between Kansas and Nebraska, that pretty much comprises the bulk of the central Great Plains. That's why we have the partnership that we do. Just to reinforce the importance, over 90% of Kansas land area is livestock and crops, and a huge precipitation gradient, like I said. Among the top two states consistently in total cattle on feed and total cattle processed, traditionally the largest wheat-producing state in the U.S., and wheat is particularly vulnerable to heat and drought stress, making me very concerned. We talked about concerns and joys earlier. Very concerned about this region and what is going to happen to agriculture given the graphics I just showed you. And Nebraska is number one in land area used for farming and ranching, top five states for total agricultural and livestock receipts, lot of irrigation, right? We want to reach agricultural producers, rural communities, and rural education. So this is about who's managing the landscape and who's going to be managing it in the future. That's really the focus. Right, two schools, centrally located. Bunch of different partners, myself, some people that are very focused on how do we have public conversations about controversial topics, folks that understand a lot about public policy development and confusing issues. Extension programs is part of our partnership, Soil Carbon Center at K-State, High Plains Regional Climate Center, a lot of climate data that we could develop into programming. Instructional innovation, we've got educators involved in this, so good educational expertise. And what have we been doing? Well, mainly we've been doing focus groups with our different communities. We have an advisory board that represents all of their needs for the most part. We've been doing a lot of research, looking at websites like that climate communication one earlier, and we're doing strategic planning. And what have we learned? We have learned that rural communities and ag producers basically are not on one side or another of the six Americas, that the populations in this area do represent generally what we're seeing nationwide. So at least we don't have an extremely biased population. It's a confused population. Producers care about how climate relates to their productivity and profitability in many cases. And community members and non-producers, when we talk to them, they typically jump straight to the national debates. They don't ask the question, how is climate going to impact my community? How does my city government need to be thinking about infrastructure based upon what we're going to be seeing in the years ahead? How does, you know, my business community need to adapt, et cetera, et cetera? People don't know who to trust. They don't trust politicians. They don't trust corporations. They don't trust scientists. But they do kind of trust university extension services, so that's a good thing. And they also trust local weathermen, although I'm not sure why. And the other thing is most people do notice evidence of changing climate, but they are not willing to admit climate change. And it's a difference of one letter. Okay? They notice climate changes, but they do not notice climate change. Bizarre how one single letter can totally change the conversation. So it's great, actually. We can actually talk. I thought we wouldn't be able to talk about climate change at all. We wouldn't even be able to use the words. We'd have to talk about it in some other set of words. But people do want to talk about it. In fact, they are talking about it. And so that's important. But the cause is we don't want to believe that our cows are the cause of climate change. How could they be causing this? They've been around for forever. Yeah. So our conclusions, well, we need to be relevant. We need to be locally relevant to the lives of people, not about some far-off political conversation. The issue of trust, I think, is one of relevance. And we need to be able to translate climate science into that locally relevant information. And so... we also need to allow people to come to their own conclusions and not tell them what to think. That involves thinking about this thing of expertise in science very carefully and trying to develop models of peer-to-peer learning and public participation in the process of data gathering and analysis, developing hands-on learning environments and relying on trusted messengers, not from maybe K-State, but even from their local communities. So if we can develop some local expertise that is trusted, respected people in communities, that's maybe a way to go. So that's what we're trying to work on with our program ideas. So I've gone over, but I don't know if you want to have any time to entertain some questions. Sure.
Stephen Mall here. What I learned from the talk, thank you very much, and from the children's story is that before Chicken Little went to Henny Penny, she should have been peer-reviewed by Chilly Willy.
Yeah.
And never trust Foxy Newsy.
Right, Foxy Newsy, right? Well, and that's the weird thing, is I don't really think people do trust Foxy Newsy. But it's distracting enough. It's distracting enough that we don't have an honest conversation.
So. We have nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
Especially in the coffee.
Uh-huh.
Coffee has no calories.
Right.
It is not a good food.
Right.
So why worry about coffee? I'm trying to be funny.
And that's a joyful statement there, I think. I don't drink coffee, so I'm fine.
Jerry Falwell also said God would never allow it.
Right. 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 Right.
Mr. Brian Boker, I have a question on the climate change. Would the climate, growing seasons and stuff just shift to other areas? Instead of wheat be in Kansas, would wheat be over in the east or something?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, I think that's a tempting thing to look at, but I'm a little concerned that it's not going to be as simple as that. If you go back to those images I was showing you about the number of 100-degree days and stuff, I don't think that's just a matter of things moving north. I mean, there is movement north. You did see the heat kind of rising. Canada will probably see more temperate winters, and there will be some of that, I think. But I have a feeling that some of the other knock-on effects, the ecological knock-on effects of pests and other things doing weird stuff, is probably going to eradicate any benefit we get from that. And I'm very concerned about that element.
For someone who doesn't know about cows, what's the cow thing? How does that work?
Well, so cows, like humans, emanate stuff. Waste gases.
Methane.
And a lot of that waste gas is methane. And methane is one of the greenhouse gases. And so carbon dioxide is we produce the most total amount of gas in the form of carbon dioxide, but different gases have different amounts of intensity in the amount of energy that they can absorb in the atmosphere, and methane absorbs about 40 times the amount of carbon dioxide by weight, okay? So if you have, our meat-dependent lifestyle involves lots and lots of cows. And in fact, they eat diets that is mainly based in grains, which is not what those types of herbivores, ungulate herbivores, were ecologically suited to eating grasses primarily. And so they produce, like you eat a lot of beans, you notice you maybe produce a lot more gas because your digestive system's not used to it. And it's the same kind of thing with cows eating grains. It fattens them up nicely. But it also produces a lot of gas. Not as many, and we've raised them differently. Yeah. Yeah. Right. 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 Yeah. Yeah. We have more people. Yeah, right. So we have more people, and they consume a lot, and the more people we have, the more we'll consume. But in addition to that, we have tremendous changes in the way that people are eating abroad. So the rise of the middle class in India and China is basically adding two more Americas to the world's consumption patterns because they're eating, they're transitioning to eat the same kind of meat-heavy diet that we are here. So, yeah, it's a big problem. Good. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for good conversation. That's great.
Thank you, Ben. We will sing our concluding hymn, number 309, Earth is Our Homeland. Please stand as you're able. Our closing words are brief. They're from Terry Swearingen. We are living on this planet as if we had another one to go to. Please join us for refreshments, and I'm sure you can accost Ben still for a few minutes if you would like to.